Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Chapter 10 of The Two Brothers by Honoré de Balzac, translated by Catherine Prescott Wormley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Bruce Peary. At the time when Madame Bridau returned to Issoudun to save, as Maître Desroches expressed it, an inheritance that was seriously threatened, Jean-Jacques Rouget had reached, by degrees, a condition that was semi-vegetative. In the first place, after Max's installment, Flore put the table on an episcopal footing. Rouget, thrown in the way of good living, ate more and still more, enticed by the Védie's excellent dishes. He grew no fatter, however, in spite of this abundant and luxurious nourishment. From day to day he weakened like a worn-out man, fatigued perhaps with the effort of digestion, and his eyes had dark circles around them. Still, when his friends and neighbors met him in his walks and questioned him about his health, he always answered that he was never better in his life. As he had always been thought extremely deficient in mind, people did not notice the constant lowering of his faculties. His love for Flore was the one thing that kept him alive. In fact, he existed only for her, and his weakness in her presence was unbounded. He obeyed the creature's mere look, and watched her movements as a dog watches every gesture of his master. In short, as Madame Auchan remarked, at 57 years of age he seemed older than Monsieur Auchan, an octogenarian. Everyone will suppose, and with reason, that Max's apartment was worthy of so charming a fellow. In fact, in the course of 6 years, our captain had by degrees perfected the comfort of his abode, and adorned every detail of it as much for his own pleasure as for Flore's. But it was, after all, only the comfort and luxury of Issoudun. Colored tiles, rather elegant wallpapers, mahogany furniture, mirrors in gilt frames, muslin curtains with red borders, a bed with a canopy, and draperies arranged as the provincial upholsterers arrange them for a rich bride, which in the eyes of Issoudun seemed the height of luxury, but are so common in vulgar fashion plates that even the petty shopkeepers in Paris have discarded them at their weddings. One very unusual thing appeared, which caused much talk in Issoudun, namely a rush matting on the stairs, no doubt to muffle the sound of feet. In fact, though Max was in the habit of coming in at daybreak, he never woke anyone, and Rouget was far from suspecting that his guest was an accomplice in the nocturnal performances of the Knights of Idleness. About 8 o'clock the next morning, Flore, wearing a dressing-gown of some pretty cotton stuff with narrow pink stripes, a lace cap on her head, and her feet in furred slippers, softly opened the door of Max's chamber. Seeing that he slept, she remained standing beside the bed. "He came in so late," she said to herself. "It was 3:30. He must have a good constitution to stand such amusements. Isn't he strong, the dear love? I wonder what they did last night."
"Oh, there you are, my little Flore," said Max, waking like a soldier trained by the necessities of war to have his wits and his self-possession about him the instant that he waked, however suddenly it might happen.
"You are sleepy. I'll go away."
"No, stay. There's something serious going on." "Were you up to some mischief last night?"
"Bah!
It concerns you and me and that old fool. You never told me he had a family. Well, his family are coming here, no doubt to turn us out, neck and crop. I'll shake him well, said Flora. Mademoiselle Brazier, said Max gravely, things are too serious for giddiness. Send me my coffee. I'll take it in bed, where I'll think over what we had better do. Come back at 9 o'clock, and we'll talk about it. Meanwhile, behave as if you had heard nothing. Frightened at the news, Flora left Max and went to make his coffee. But a quarter of an hour later, Baruch burst into Max's bedroom, crying out to the Grand Master, "Fario is hunting for his barrow." In 5 minutes Max was dressed and in the street, and though he sauntered along with apparent indifference, he soon reached the foot of the tower embankment, where he found quite a collection of people. "What is it?" asked Max, making his way through the crowd and reaching the Spaniard. Fario was a withered little man, as ugly as though he were a blue-blooded grandee. His fiery eyes, placed very close to his nose and piercing as a gimlet, would have won him the name of a sorcerer in Naples. He seemed gentle because he was calm, quiet, and slow in his movements, and for this reason people commonly called him Good Man Fario. But his skin, the color of gingerbread, and his softness of manner only hid from stupid eyes, and disclosed to observing ones, the half-Moorish nature of a peasant of Granada, which nothing had as yet roused from its phlegmatic indolence. "Are you sure," Max said to him, after listening to his grievance, "that you brought your cart to this place? For, thank God, there are no thieves in Issoudun." "I left it just there." "If the horse was harnessed to it, hasn't he drawn it somewhere?" "Here's the horse," said Fario, pointing to the animal, which stood harnessed 30 feet away. Max went gravely up to the place where the horse stood, because from there the bottom of the tower at the top of the embankment could be seen, the crowd being at the foot of the mound. Everybody followed Max, and that was what the scoundrel wanted.
"Has anybody thoughtlessly put a cart in his pocket?" cried Francois.
"Turn out your pockets, all of you," said Baruch. Shouts of laughter resounded on all sides. Fario swore. Oaths, with a Spaniard, denote the highest pitch of anger.
"Was your cart light?" asked Max. "Light!" cried Fario. "If those who laugh at me had it on their feet, their corns would never hurt them again."
"Well, it must be devilishly light," answered Max, "for look there!" pointing to the foot of the tower, "it has flown up the embankment." At these words all eyes were lifted to the spot, and for a moment there was a perfect uproar in the marketplace. Each man pointed at the barrow bewitched, and all their tongues wagged.
"The devil makes common cause with the innkeepers," said Godet to the astonished Spaniard. "He means to teach you not to leave your cart about in the streets, but to put it in the tavern stables." At this speech the crowd hooted, for Fario was thought to be a miser.
"Come, my good fellow," said Max, "don't lose heart. We'll go up to the tower and see how your barrow got there. Thunder and cannon, we'll lend you a hand. Come along, Baruch." "As for you," he whispered to Francois, "get the people to stand back, and make sure there is nobody at the foot of the embankment when you see us at the top." Fario, Max, Baruch, and three other knights climbed to the foot of the tower. During the rather perilous ascent, Max and Fario noticed that no damage to the embankment, nor even trace of the passage of the barrow, could be seen. Fario began to imagine witchcraft, and lost his head.
When they reached the top and examined into the matter, it really seemed a thing impossible that the cart had got there.
"How shall I ever get it down?" said the Spaniard, whose little eyes began for the first time to show fear,
while his swarthy yellow face, which seemed as if it could never change color, whitened.
"How?" said Max. "Why, that's not difficult."
And taking advantage of the Spaniard's stupefaction, he raised the barrel by the shafts with his robust arms and prepared to fling it down, calling in thundering tones as it left his grasp, "Look out there below!" No accident happened, for the crowd, persuaded by Francois and eaten up with curiosity, had retired to a distance from which they could see more clearly what went on at the top of the embankment. The cart was dashed to an infinite number of pieces in a very picturesque manner.
"There, you have got it down," said Baruch.
"Ah, brigands! Ah, scoundrels!" cried Fario. "Perhaps it was you who brought it up here."
Max, Baruch, and their three comrades began to laugh at the Spaniard's rage.
"I wanted to do you a service," said Max coolly, "and in handling the damned thing I came very near flinging myself after it, and this is how you thank me, is it? What country do you come from?"
"I come from a country where they never forgive," replied Fario, trembling with rage. "My cart will be the cab in which you shall drive to the devil, unless," he said, suddenly becoming as meek as a lamb, "you will give me a new one."
"We will talk about that," said Max, beginning to descend.
When they reached the bottom and met the first hilarious group, Max took Fario by the button of his jacket and said to him,
"Yes, my good Fario, I'll give you a magnificent cart if you will give me 250 francs, but I won't warrant it to go, like this one, up a tower."
At this last jest, Fario became as cool as though he were making a bargain.
"Damn it!" he said. "Give me the wherewithal to replace my barrow, and it will be the best use you ever made of old Rouget's money."
Max turned livid. He raised his formidable fist to strike Fario, but Baruch, who knew that the blow would descend on others besides the Spaniard, plucked the latter away like a feather and whispered to Max, "Don't commit such a folly." The Grand Master, thus called to order, began to laugh and said to Fario, "If I by accident broke your barrow, and you in return try to slander me, we are quits."
"Not yet," muttered Fario, "but I am glad to know what my barrow was worth."
"Ah, Max, you've found your match," said a spectator of the scene who did not belong to the Order of Idleness.
"Adieu, Monsieur Gilet. I haven't thanked you yet for lending me a hand," cried the Spaniard, as he kicked the sides of his horse and disappeared amid loud hurrahs.
"We will keep the tires of the wheels for you," shouted a wheelwright who had come to inspect the damage done to the cart. One of the shafts was sticking upright in the ground, as straight as a tree. Max stood by, pale and thoughtful, and deeply annoyed by Fario's speech. For 5 days after this nothing was talked of in Issoudun but the tale of the Spaniard's barrow. It was even fated to travel abroad, as Godet remarked, for it went the round of Berry, where the speeches of Fario and Max were repeated, and at the end of a week the affair, greatly to the Spaniard's satisfaction, was still the talk of the three departments and the subject of endless gossip. In consequence of the vindictive Spaniard's terrible speech, Max and the Rabouilleuses became the object of certain comments which were merely whispered in Issoudun, though they were spoken aloud in Bourges, Vatan, Vierzon, and Châteauroux.
Maxence Gilet knew enough of that region of the country to guess how envenomed such comments would become. "We can't stop their tongues," he said at last. "I did a foolish thing."
"Max," said Francois, taking his arm, "they are coming tonight."
"They? Who?"
"The Brideaus.
My grandmother has just had a letter from her goddaughter." "Listen, my boy," said Max in a low voice. "I have been thinking deeply of this matter. Neither Flore nor I ought to seem opposed to the Brideaus. If those heirs are to be got rid of, it is for you Auchans to drive them out of Issoudun. Find out what sort of people they are. Tomorrow, at Mère Cognette's, after I've taken their measure, we can decide what is to be done, and how we can set your grandfather against them." "The Spaniard found the flaw in Max's armor," said Baruch to his cousin Francois, as they turned into Monsieur Auchan's house and watched their comrade entering his own door. While Max was thus employed, Flore, in spite of her friend's advice, was unable to restrain her wrath, and without knowing whether she would help or hinder Max's plans, she burst forth upon the poor bachelor. When Jean-Jacques incurred the anger of his mistress, the little attentions and vulgar fondlings which were all his joy were suddenly suppressed. Flore sent her master, as the children say, into disgrace. No more tender glances, no more of the caressing little words in various tones with which she decked her conversation. "My kitten, my old darling, my Bibi, my rat," etc. "Ah, you, cold and sharp and ironically respectful, cut like the blade of a knife through the heart of the miserable old bachelor. The you was a declaration of war. Instead of helping the poor man with his toilet, handing him what he wanted, forestalling his wishes, looking at him with the sort of admiration which all women know how to express, and which in some cases the coarser it is the better it pleases, saying, for instance, 'You look as fresh as a rose,' or 'What health you have! How handsome you are, my old Jean!' In short, instead of entertaining him with the lively chatter and broad jokes in which he delighted, Flore left him to dress alone. If he called her, she answered from the foot of the staircase, 'I can't do everything at once. How can I look after your breakfast and wait upon you up there? Are not you big enough to dress your own self?' 'Oh, dear, what have I done to displease her?' the old man asked himself that morning, as he got one of these rebuffs after calling for his shaving water.
"Vedi, take up the hot water," cried Flore.
"Vedi," exclaimed the poor man, stupefied with fear of the anger that was crushing him,
"Vedi, what is the matter with Madame this morning?"
Flore Brazier required her master and Vedi and Kowski and Max to call her Madame.
"She seems to have heard something about you which isn't to your credit," answered Vedi, assuming an air of deep concern. "You are doing wrong, monsieur. I'm only a poor servant-woman, and you may say I have no right to poke my nose into your affairs, but I do say you may search through all the women in the world, like that king in Holy Scripture, and you won't find the equal of Madame. You ought to kiss the ground she steps on. Goodness, if you make her unhappy, you'll only spoil your own life. There she is, poor thing, with her eyes full of tears."
Vedi left the poor man utterly cast down. He dropped into an armchair and gazed into vacancy like the melancholy imbecile that he was, and forgot to shave. These alternations of tenderness and severity worked upon this feeble creature, whose only life was through his amorous fiber, the same morbid effect which great changes from tropical heat to arctic cold produce upon the human body. It was a moral pleurisy, which wore him out like a physical disease. Flore alone could thus affect him, for to her, and to her alone, he was as good as he was foolish.
"Well, haven't you shaved yet?"
she said, appearing at his door. Her sudden presence made the old man start violently, and from being pale and cast down, he grew red for an instant, without, however, daring to complain of her treatment.
"Your breakfast is waiting," she added. "You can come down as you are, in dressing-gown and slippers, for you'll breakfast alone, I can tell you."
Without waiting for an answer, she disappeared. To make him breakfast alone was the punishment he dreaded most. He loved to talk to her as he ate his meals. When he got to the foot of the staircase, he was taken with a fit of coughing, for emotion excited his catarrh.
"Cough away," said Flore in the kitchen, without caring whether he heard her or not. "Confound the old wretch! He is able enough to get over it without bothering others. If he coughs up his soul, it will only be after—"
Such were the amenities the Rabouilleuse addressed to Rouget when she was angry. The poor man sat down in deep distress at a corner of the table in the middle of the room, and looked at his old furniture and the old pictures with a disconsolate air.
"You might at least have put on a cravat," said Flore. "Do you think it is pleasant for people to see such a neck as yours, which is redder and more wrinkled than a turkey's?"
"But what have I done?"
he asked, lifting his big light-green eyes, full of tears, to his tormentor, and trying to face her hard countenance.
"What have you done?" she exclaimed. "As if you didn't know! Oh, what a hypocrite! Your sister Agathe, who is as much your sister as I am sister of the Tower of Issoudun, if one's to believe your father, and who has no claim at all upon you, is coming here from Paris with her son, a miserable twopenny painter, to see you."
"My sister and my nephews coming to Issoudun?" he said, bewildered.
"Oh, yes, play the surprised, do. Try to make me believe you didn't send for them. Sowing your lies with white bread, indeed. Don't fash yourself. We won't trouble your Parisians. Before they set their feet in this house, we shall have shaken the dust of it off ours. Max and I will be gone, never to return. As for your will, I'll tear it in quarters under your nose and to your very beard, do you hear? Leave your property to your family, if you don't think we are your family, and then see if you'll be loved for yourself by a lot of people who have not seen you for 30 years, who in fact have never seen you. Is it that sort of sister who can take my place? A pinchbeck saint?
If that's all, my little Flore, said the old man, I won't receive my sister or my nephews. I swear to you, this is the first word I have heard of their coming. It's all got up by that Madame Auchan, a sanctimonious old—
Max, who had overheard old Rouget's words, entered suddenly and said in a masterful tone,
What's all this?
My good Max, said the old man, glad to get the protection of the soldier, who, by agreement with Flore, always took his side in a dispute. I swear by all that is most sacred that I now hear this news for the first time. I have never written to my sister. My father made me promise not to leave her any of my property, to leave it to the church sooner than to her. Well, I won't receive my sister Agathe to this house, or her sons.
Your father was wrong, my dear Jean-Jacques, and Madame Brazier is still more wrong, answered Max. Your father no doubt had his reasons, but he is dead, and his hatred should die with him. Your sister is your sister, and your nephews are your nephews. You owe it to yourself to welcome them, and you owe it to us as well. What would people say in Issoudun? Thunder, I've got enough upon my shoulders as it is, without hearing people say that we shut you up and don't allow you a will of your own, or that we influence you against your relations and are trying to get hold of your property. The devil take me if I don't pull up stakes and be off, if that sort of calumny is to be flung at me. The other is bad enough. Let's eat our breakfast. Flore, who was now as mild as a weasel, helped Védie to set the table. Old Rouget, full of admiration for Max, took him by both hands and led him into the recess of a window, saying in a low voice, "Ah, Max, if I had a son, I couldn't love him better than I love you. Flore is right. You two are my real family. You are a man of honor, Max, and what you have just said is true. You ought to receive and entertain your sister and her son, but not change the arrangements you have made about your property," said Max. "In that way, you will do what is right in the eyes of the world, and yet keep your promise to your father."
"Well, my dear loves," cried Flore, gaily, "the thalmy is getting cold. Come, my old rat, here's a wing for you," she said, smiling on Jean-Jacques.
At the words, the long-drawn face of the poor creature lost its cadaverous tints. The smile of a teriyaki flickered upon his pendant lips, but he was seized with another fit of coughing, for the joy of being taken back to favor excited as violent an emotion as the punishment itself. Flore rose, pulled a little cashmere shawl from her own shoulders, and tied it round the old man's throat, exclaiming, "How silly to put yourself in such a way about nothing! There, you old goose, that will do you good. It has been next my heart."
"What a good creature!" said Rouget to Max, while Flore went to fetch a black velvet cap to cover the nearly bald head of the old bachelor.
"As good as she is beautiful," answered Max, "but she is quick-tempered, like all people who carry their hearts in their hands." The baldness of this sketch may displease some who will think the flashes of Flora's character belong to the sort of realism which a painter ought to leave in shadow. Well, this scene, played again and again with shocking variations, is, in its coarse way and its horrible veracity, the type of such scenes played by women on whatever rung of the social ladder they are perched, when any interest, no matter what, draws them from their own line of obedience and induces them to grasp at power. In their eyes, as in those of politicians, all means to an end are justifiable. Between Flore Brazier and a duchess, between a duchess and the richest bourgeoise, between a bourgeoise and the most luxuriously kept mistress, there are no differences except those of the education they have received and the surroundings in which they live. The pouting of a fine lady is the same thing as the violence of a rabouilleuse. At all levels, bitter sayings, ironical jests, cold contempt, hypocritical complaints, false quarrels win as much success as the low outbursts of this Madame Évrard of Issoudun. Max began to relate with much humor the tale of Fario and his barrow, which made the old man laugh. Védie and Kowski, who came to listen, exploded in the kitchen, and as to Flore, she laughed convulsively. After breakfast, while Jean-Jacques read the newspapers, for they subscribed to the Constitutionnel and the Pandore, Max carried Flore to his own quarters. "Are you quite sure he has not made any other will since the one in which he left the property to you?"
"'He hasn't anything to write with,' she answered.
"'He might have dictated it to some notary,' said Max. "'We must look out for that. "'Therefore, it is well to be cordial to the Brideaus, "'and at the same time endeavour to turn those mortgages into money. "'The notaries will be only too glad to make the transfers. "'It is grist to their mill. "'The funds are going up. "'We shall conquer Spain and deliver Ferdinand the Seventh and the Cortez.' And then they will be above par. You and I could make a good thing out of it by putting the old fellow's 750,000 francs into the funds at 89. Only you must try to get it done in your name. It will be so much secured, anyhow.
A capital idea, said Flore.
And as there will be an income of 50,000 francs from 890,000, "'We must make him borrow 140,000 francs for 2 years, "'to be paid back in 2 installments. "'In 2 years we shall get 100,000 francs in Paris, "'and 90,000 here, and risk nothing.
"'If it were not for you, my handsome Max, "'what would become of me now?' she said.
"'Oh, tomorrow night at Mère Cognette's, after I have seen the Parisians, I shall find a way to make the Auchans themselves get rid of them.'
"'Ah, what a head you've got, my angel! You are a love of a man!'
The Place Saint-Jean is at the centre of a long street called, at the upper end, the Rue Grande Narette, and at the lower, the Rue Petite Narette. The word Narette is used in Berry to express the same lay of the land as the Genoese word Salita indicates, that is to say, a steep street. The Grand Narette rises rapidly from the Place Saint-Jean to the Porte Villette. The house of old Monsieur Auchan is exactly opposite that of Jean-Jacques Rouget. From the windows of the room where Madame Auchan usually sat, it was easy to see what went on at the Rouget household, and vice versa, when the curtains were drawn back or the doors were left open. The Auchan house was like the Rouget house, and the two were doubtless built by the same architect. Monsieur Auchan, formerly tax collector at Celle, in Berry, born, however, at Issoudun, had returned to his native place and married the sister of the sub-delegate, the gay Lousteau, exchanging his office at Celle for another of the same kind at Issoudun. Having retired before 1787, he escaped the dangers of the Revolution, to whose principles, however, he firmly adhered, like all other honest men who howl with the winners. Monsieur Auchan came honestly by the reputation of miser, but it would be mere repetition to sketch him here. A single specimen of the avarice which made him famous will suffice to make you see Monsieur Auchan as he was. At the wedding of his daughter, now dead, who married a Borniche, it was necessary to give a dinner to the Borniche family. The bridegroom, who was heir to a large fortune, had suffered great mortification from having mismanaged his property, and still more because his father and mother refused to help him out. The old people, who were living at the time of the marriage, were delighted to see Monsieur Auchan step in as guardian, for the purpose, of course, of making his daughter's dowry secure. On the day of the dinner, which was given to celebrate the signing of the marriage contract, the chief relations of the two families were assembled in the salon, the Auchans on one side, the Borniches on the other, all in their best clothes. While the contract was being solemnly read aloud by young Aillon, the notary, the cook came into the room and asked Monsieur Auchan for some twine to truss up the turkey, an essential feature of the repast. The old man dove into the pocket of his surtout, pulled out an end of a string which had evidently already served to tie up a parcel, and gave it to her,
but before she could leave the room he called out, "Greet, mind you give it back to me." Greet is the abbreviation used in Berry for Marguerite. From year to year, old Auchan grew more petty in his meanness and more penurious, and at this time he was 85 years old. He belonged to the class of men who stop short in the street in the middle of a lively dialogue and stoop to pick up a pin, remarking as they stick it in the sleeve of their coat, "There's the wife's stipend." He complained bitterly of the poor quality of the cloth manufactured nowadays, and called attention to the fact that his coat had lasted only 10 years. Tall, gaunt, thin, and sallow, saying little, reading little, and doing nothing to fatigue himself, as observant of forms as an Oriental, he enforced in his own house a discipline of strict abstemiousness, weighing and measuring out the food and drink of the family, which indeed was rather numerous, and consisted of his wife, née Lousteau, his grandson Borniche, with a sister Adolphine, the heirs of old Borniche, and lastly his other grandson, François Auchan. Auchan's eldest son was taken by the draft of 1813, which drew in the sons of well-to-do families who had escaped the regular conscription and were now formed into a corps styled the Guards of Honor. This heir presumptive, who was killed at Hanau, had married early in life a rich woman, intending thereby to escape all conscriptions. But after he was enrolled, he wasted his substance under a presentiment of his end. His wife, who followed the army at a distance, died at Strasbourg in 1814, leaving debts which her father-in-law Auchan refused to pay, answering the creditors with an axiom of ancient law, "Women are minors." The house, though large, was scantily furnished. On the second floor, however, there were two rooms suitable for Madame Brideau and Joseph. Old Auchan now repented that he had kept them furnished with two beds, each bed accompanied by an old armchair of natural wood covered with needlework, and a walnut table on which figured a water-pitcher of the wide-mouthed kind called Goulard, standing in a basin with a blue border. The old man kept his winter store of apples and pears, medlars and quinces, on heaps of straw in these rooms, where the rats and mice ran riot, so that they exhaled a mingled odor of fruit and vermin. Madame Auchan now directed that everything should be cleaned. The wallpaper, which had peeled off in places, was fastened up again with wafers, and she decorated the windows with little curtains which she pieced together from old hoards of her own. Her husband having refused to let her buy a strip of drugget, she laid down her own bedside carpet for her little Agathe. "Poor little thing," as she called the mother, who was now over 47 years old. Madame Auchan borrowed two night-tables from a neighbor, and boldly hired two chests of drawers with brass handles from a dealer in second-hand furniture who lived next to Mère Cognette. She herself had preserved two pairs of candlesticks, carved in choice woods by her own father, who had the turning mania. From 1770 to 1780 it was the fashion among rich people to learn a trade, and Monsieur Lousteau, the father, was a turner, just as Louis XVI was a locksmith. These candlesticks were ornamented with circlets made of the roots of rose, peach, and apricot trees. Madame Auchan actually risked the use of her precious relics. These preparations and this sacrifice increased old Auchan's anxiety. Up to this time he had not believed in the arrival of the Brideaus.
The morning of the day that was celebrated by the trick on Fario, Madame Auchan said to her husband, after breakfast,
"I hope, Auchan, that you will receive my goddaughter, Madame Rideau, properly."
Then, after making sure that her grandchildren were out of hearing, she added,
"I am mistress of my own property. Don't oblige me to make up to Agathe, in my will, for any incivility on your part."
"Do you think, madame," answered Auchan in a mild voice, "that at my age I don't know the forms of decent civility?"
"You know very well what I mean, you crafty old thing. Be friendly to our guests, and remember that I love Agathe."
"And you love Maxence Gilet also, who is getting the property away from your dear Agathe. Ah, you've warmed a viper in your bosom there. But, after all, the Rouget money is bound to go to a Lousteau."
After making this allusion to the supposed parentage of both Max and Agathe, Auchan turned to leave the room. But old Madame Auchan, a woman still erect and spare, wearing a round cap with ribbon knots and her hair powdered, a taffet petticoat of changeable colors like a pigeon's breast, tight sleeves, and her feet in high-heeled slippers, deposited her snuff-box on a little table, and said,
"Really, Monsieur Auchan, how can a man of your sense repeat absurdities which unhappily cost my poor friend her peace of mind, and Agathe the property which she ought to have had from her father? Max Gilet is not the son of my brother, whom I often advised to save the money he paid for him. You know as well as I do that Madame Rouget was virtue itself."
"And the daughter takes after her, for she strikes me as uncommonly stupid. After losing all her fortune, she brings her sons up so well that here is one in prison and likely to be brought up on a criminal indictment before the court of peers for a conspiracy worthy of Berton. As for the other, he is worse off. He's a painter. If your protégés are to stay here till they have extricated that fool of a Rouget from the claws of Gilet and the Rabouilleuse, we shall eat a good deal more than half a measure of salt with them."
"That's enough, Monsieur Auchan. You had better wish that they may not have two strings to their bow."
Monsieur Auchan took his hat and his cane with an ivory knob, and went away petrified by that terrible speech, for he had no idea that his wife could show such resolution. Madame Auchan took her prayer-book to read the service, for her advanced age prevented her from going daily to church. It was only with difficulty that she got there on Sundays and holidays. Since receiving her goddaughter's letter, she had added a petition to her usual prayers, supplicating God to open the eyes of Jean-Jacques Rouget, and to bless Agathe and prosper the expedition into which she herself had drawn her. Concealing the fact from her grandchildren, whom she accused of being parpaillots, she had asked the curate to say a mass for Agathe's success during a neuvaine which was being held by her granddaughter, Adolphine Borniche, who thus made her prayers in church by proxy. Adolphine, then 18, who for the last 7 years had sewed at the side of her grandmother in that cold household of monotonous and methodical customs, had undertaken her neuvaine all the more willingly because she hoped to inspire some feeling in Joseph Bridau, in whom she took the deepest interest because of the monstrosities which her grandfather attributed, in her hearing, to the young Parisian. All the old people and sensible people of the town and the fathers of families approved of Madame Auchan's conduct in receiving her goddaughter,
and their good wishes for the latter's success were in proportion to the secret contempt with which the conduct of Maxence Gilet had long inspired them. Thus, the news of the arrival of Rouget's sister and nephew raised two parties in Issoudun, that of the higher and older bourgeoisie, who contented themselves with offering good wishes and in watching events without assisting them, and that of the knights of idleness and the partisans of Max, who unfortunately were capable of committing many high-handed outrages against the Parisians. End of chapter 10. Chapter 11 of The Two Brothers by Honoré de Balzac, translated by Catherine Prescott Wormley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Bruce Peary. Agathe and Joseph arrived at the coach office of the Messagerie Royale in the Place Misère at 3 o'clock. Though tired with the journey, Madame Bridau felt her youth revive at sight of her native land, where at every step she came upon memories and impressions of her girlish days. In the then condition of public opinion in Issoudun, the arrival of the Parisians was known all over the town in 10 minutes. Madame Auchan came out upon her doorstep to welcome her godchild and kissed her as though she were really a daughter. After 72 years of a barren and monotonous existence, exhibiting in their retrospect the graves of her 3 children, all unhappy in their lives and all dead, she had come to feel a sort of fictitious motherhood for the young girl whom she had, as she expressed it, carried in her pouch for 16 years. Through the gloom of provincial life, the old woman had cherished this early friendship, this girlish memory, as closely as if Agathe had remained near her, and she had also taken the deepest interest in Bridau. Agathe was led in triumph to the salon where Monsieur Auchan was stationed, chilling as a tepid oven. "Here is Monsieur Auchan. How does he seem to you?" asked his wife. "Precisely the same as when I last saw him," said the Parisian woman.
"Ah, it is easy to see you come from Paris. You are so complimentary," remarked the old man.
The presentations took place. First, young Baruch Borniche, a tall youth of 22, then François Auchan, 24, and lastly little Adolphine, who blushed and did not know what to do with her arms. She was anxious not to seem to be looking at Joseph Bridau, who in his turn was narrowly observed, though from different points of view, by the 2 young men and by old Auchan. The miser was saying to himself, "He is just out of the hospital. He will be as hungry as a convalescent." The young men were saying, "What a head! What a brigand! We shall have our hands full." "This is my son, the painter, my good Joseph," said Agathe at last, presenting the artist. There was an effort in the accent that she put upon the word good, which revealed the mother's heart, whose thoughts were really in the prison of the Luxembourg.
"He looks ill," said Madame Auchan. "He is not at all like you."
"No, madame," said Joseph, with the brusque candor of an artist. "I am like my father, and very ugly at that." Madame Auchan pressed Agathe's hand, which she was holding, and glanced at her as much as to say, "Ah, my child, I understand now why you prefer your good-for-nothing Philippe."
"I never saw your father, my dear boy," she said aloud. "It is enough to make me love you that you are your mother's son. Besides, you have talent. So the late Madame Descoings used to write to me. She was the only one of late years who told me much about you."
"Talent!" exclaimed the artist. "Not as yet, but with time and patience I may win fame and fortune."
"By painting," said Monsieur Auchan ironically.
"Come, Adelphine," said Madame Auchan, "go and see about dinner."
"Mother," said Joseph, "I will attend to the trunks which they are bringing in."
"Auchan," said the grandmother to Francois, "show the rooms to Monsieur Bridau."
As the dinner was to be served at 4 o'clock, and it was now only 3:30, Baruch rushed into the town to tell the news of the Bridau arrival, describe Agathe's dress, and more particularly to picture Joseph, whose haggard, unhealthy, and determined face was not unlike the ideal of a brigand. That evening Joseph was the topic of conversation in all the households of Issoudun.
"That sister of Rouget must have seen a monkey before her son was born," said one. "He is the image of a baboon."
"He has the face of a brigand and the eyes of a basilisk."
"All artists are like that."
"They are as wicked as the red ass and as spiteful as monkeys."
"It is part of their business."
"I have just seen Monsieur Bossier, and he says he would not like to meet him in that dark wood.
He saw him in the diligence."
"He has got hollows over the eyes like a horse, and he laughs like a maniac."
"The fellow looks as though he were capable of anything. Perhaps it's his fault that his brother, a fine handsome man, they tell me, has gone to the bad. Poor Madame Bridau doesn't seem as if she were very happy with him."
"Suppose we take advantage of his being here and have our portraits painted."
The result of all these observations scattered through the town was naturally to excite curiosity. All those who had the right to visit the Auchans resolved to call that very night and examine the Parisians. The arrival of these two persons in the stagnant town was like the falling of a beam into a community of frogs. After stowing his mother's things and his own into the two attic chambers, which he examined as he did so, Joseph took note of the silent house, where the walls, the staircase, the woodwork, were devoid of decoration and humid with frost, and where there was literally nothing beyond the merest necessaries. He felt the brusque transition from his poetic Paris to the dumb and arid province, and when coming downstairs he chanced to see Monsieur Auchan cutting slices of bread for each person, he understood, for the first time in his life, Molière's Harpagon. "We should have done better to go to an inn," he said to himself. The aspect of the dinner confirmed his apprehensions. After a soup whose watery clearness showed that quantity was more considered than quality, the bouilli was served, ceremoniously garnished with parsley, the vegetables in a dish by themselves being counted into the items of the repast. The bouilli held the place of honour in the middle of the table, accompanied with three other dishes: hard-boiled eggs on sorrel opposite to the vegetables, then a salad dressed with nut oil to face little cups of custard, whose flavouring of burnt oats did service as vanilla, which it resembles much as coffee made of chicory resembles mocha. Butter and radishes in two plates were at each end of the table. Pickled gherkins and horseradish completed the spread, which won Madame Auchan's approbation. The good old woman gave a contented little nod when she saw that her husband had done things properly, for the first day at least. The old man answered with a glance and a shrug of his shoulders, which it was easy to translate into, "See the extravagances you force me to commit." As soon as Monsieur Auchan had, as it were, slivered the bouilli into slices, about as thick as the sole of a dancing shoe, that dish was replaced by another containing three pigeons. The wine was of the country, vintage 1811.
On a hint from her grandmother, Adolphine had decorated each end of the table with a bunch of flowers. "At Rome, as the Romans do," thought the artist, looking at the table and beginning to eat, like a man who had breakfasted at Vierzon at 6 o'clock in the morning on an execrable cup of coffee. When Joseph had eaten up all his bread and asked for more, Monsieur Auchan rose, slowly searched in the pocket of his surtout for a key, unlocked a cupboard behind him, broke off a section of a 12-pound loaf, carefully cut a round of it, then divided the round in two, laid the pieces on a plate, and passed the plate across the table to the young painter, with the silence and coolness of an old soldier who says to himself on the eve of battle, "Well, I can meet death." Joseph took the half-slice, and fully understood that he was not to ask for any more. No member of the family was the least surprised at this extraordinary performance. The conversation went on. Agathe learned that the house in which she was born, her father's house before he inherited that of the old Descoings, had been bought by the Borniches. She expressed a wish to see it once more. "No doubt," said her godmother, "the Borniches will be here this evening. We shall have half the town, who want to examine you," she added, turning to Joseph, "and they will all invite you to their houses." Grete, who, in spite of her 60 years, was the only servant of the house, brought in for dessert the famous ripe cheese of Touraine and Berry, made of goat's milk, whose mouldy discolorations so distinctly reproduced the pattern of the vine leaves on which it is served, that Touraine ought to have invented the art of engraving. On either side of these little cheeses, Grete, with a company air, placed nuts and some time-honored biscuits.
"Well, Grete, the fruit?" said Madame Auchan.
"But, madame, there is none rotten," answered Grete. Joseph went off into roars of laughter, as though he were among his comrades in the atelier, for he suddenly perceived that the parsimony of eating only the fruits which were beginning to rot had degenerated into a settled habit.
"Bah, we can eat them all the same," he exclaimed, with the heedless gaiety of a man who will have his say.
"Monsieur Auchan, pray get some," said the old lady.
Monsieur Auchan, much incensed at the artist's speech, fetched some peaches, pears, and St. Catherine plums.
"Adolphine, go and gather some grapes," said Madame Auchan to her granddaughter.
Joseph looked at the two young men as much as to say, "Is it to such high living as this that you owe your healthy faces?" Baruch understood the keen glance and smiled, for he and his cousin Auchan were behaving with much discretion. The home life was of less importance to youths who supped three times the week at Mère Cognette's. Moreover, just before dinner, Baruch had received notice that the Grand Master convoked the whole order at midnight for a magnificent supper, in the course of which a great enterprise would be arranged. The feast of welcome given by old Auchan to his guests explains how necessary were the nocturnal repasts at the Cognettes to two young fellows blessed with good appetites, who, we may add, never missed any of them.
"We will take the liqueur in the salon," said Madame Auchan,
rising and motioning to Joseph to give her his arm. As they went out before the others, she whispered to the painter,
"Eh, my poor boy, this dinner won't give you an indigestion, but I had hard work to get it for you. It is always Lent here. You will get enough just to keep life in you, and no more, so you must bear it patiently."
The kind-heartedness of the old woman, who thus drew her own predicament, pleased the artist.
I have lived 50 years with that man without ever hearing half a dozen gold pieces chink in my purse," she went on. "Oh, if I did not hope that you might save your property, I would never have brought you and your mother into my prison."
"But how can you survive it?" cried Joseph naively, with the gaiety which a French artist never loses.
"Ah, you may well ask," she said. "I pray."
Joseph quivered as he heard the words, which raised the old woman so much in his estimation that he stepped back a little way to look into her face. It was radiant with so tender a serenity that he said to her,
"Let me paint your portrait."
"No, no," she answered, "I am too weary of life to wish to remain here on canvas." Gaily uttering the sad words, she opened a closet and brought out a flask containing ratafia, a domestic manufacture of her own, the receipt for which she obtained from the far-famed nuns, to whom is also due the celebrated cake of Sedan, one of the great creations of French confectionery, which no chef, cook, pastry cook, or confectioner has ever been able to reproduce. Monsieur de Rivière, ambassador at Constantinople, ordered enormous quantities every year for the seraglio. Adolphine held a lacquer tray on which were a number of little old glasses with engraved sides and gilt edges, and as her grandmother filled each of them, she carried it to the company.
"It seems as though my father's turn were coming round," exclaimed Agathe, to whom this immutable provincial custom recalled the scenes of her youth. "Auchan will go to his club presently to read the papers, and we shall have a little time to ourselves," said the old lady in a low voice. In fact, 10 minutes later, the three women and Joseph were alone in the salon, where the floor was never waxed, only swept, and the worsted work designs in oaken frames with grooved mouldings and all the other plain and rather dismal furniture seemed to Madame Bridau to be in exactly the same state as when she had left Issoudun. Monarchy, revolution, empire, and restoration, which respected little, had certainly respected this room, where their glories and their disasters had left not the slightest trace.
"Ah, my godmother, in comparison with your life, mine has been cruelly tried," exclaimed Madame Bridau, surprised to find even a canary which she had known when alive stuffed and standing on the mantel-shelf between the old clock, the old brass brackets, and the silver candlesticks.
"My child," said the old lady, "trials are in the heart. The greater and more necessary the resignation, the harder the struggle with our own selves. But don't speak of me. Let us talk of your affairs. You are directly in front of the enemy," she added, pointing to the windows of the Rouget house.
"They are sitting down to dinner," said Adolphine.
The young girl, destined for a cloister, was constantly looking out of the window, in hopes of getting some light upon the enormities imputed to Maxence Gilet, the Rabouilleuse, and Jean-Jacques, of which a few words reached her ears whenever she was sent out of the room that others might talk about them. The old lady now told her granddaughter to leave her alone with Madame Bridau and Joseph until the arrival of visitors. "For," she said, turning to the Parisians, "I know my Issoudun by heart. We shall have 10 or 12 batches of inquisitive folk here to-night." In fact, Madame Auchan had hardly related the events and the details concerning the astounding influence obtained by Maxence Gilet and the Rabouilleuse over Jean-Jacques Rouget, without, of course, following the synthetical method with which they have been presented here, adding the many comments, descriptions, and hypotheses with which the good and evil tongues of the town embroidered them, before Adolphine announced the approach of the Borniche, Bossier, Lousteau-Prangin, Fichet, Godet-Hérault families,
in all 14 persons looming in the distance. "You now see, my dear child," said the old lady, concluding her tale, "that it will not be an easy matter to get this property out of the jaws of the wolf. It seems to me so difficult, with a scoundrel such as you represent him, and a daring woman like that crab girl, as to be actually impossible," remarked Joseph. "We should have to stay a year in Issoudun to counteract their influence and overthrow their dominion over my uncle. Money isn't worth such a struggle, not to speak of the meannesses to which we should have to condescend. My mother has only 2 weeks' leave of absence. Her place is a permanent one, and she must not risk it. As for me, in the month of October I have an important work, which Schinner has just obtained for me from a peer of France. So, you see, madame, my future fortune is in my brushes." This speech was received by Madame Auchan with much amazement. Though relatively superior to the town she lived in, the old lady did not believe in painting. She glanced at her goddaughter and again pressed her hand. "This Maxence is the second volume of Philippe," whispered Joseph in his mother's ear, "only cleverer and better behaved. Well, madame," he said aloud, "we won't trouble Monsieur Auchan by staying very long." "Ah, you are young, you know nothing of the world," said the old lady. "A couple of weeks, if you are judicious, may produce great results. Listen to my advice, and act accordingly." "Oh, willingly," said Joseph. "I know I have a perfectly amazing incapacity for domestic statesmanship. For example, I am sure I don't know what Desroches himself would tell us to do if my uncle declines to see us." Madame Borniche, Godet-Hérault, Bossier, Lustol, Prangin, and Fichet, decorated with their husbands, here entered the room. When the 14 persons were seated and the usual compliments were over, Madame Auchan presented her goddaughter Agathe and Joseph. Joseph sat in his armchair all the evening, engaged in slyly studying the 60 faces which, from 5 o'clock until 9:30, posed for him gratis, as he afterwards told his mother. Such behavior before the aristocracy of Issoudun did not tend to change the opinion of the little town concerning him. Everyone went home ruffled by his sarcastic glances, uneasy under his smiles, and even frightened at his face, which seemed sinister to a class of people unable to recognize the singularities of genius. After 10 o'clock, when the household was in bed, Madame Auchan kept her goddaughter in her chamber until midnight. Secure from interruption, the two women told each other the sorrows of their lives and exchanged their sufferings. As Agathe listened to the last echoes of a soul that had missed its destiny, and felt the sufferings of a heart essentially generous and charitable, whose charity and generosity could never be exercised, she realized the immensity of the desert in which the powers of this noble, unrecognized soul had been wasted, and knew that she herself, with the little joys and interests of her city life relieving the bitter trials sent from God, was not the most unhappy of the two. "You who are so pious," she said, "explain to me my shortcomings. Tell me what it is that God is punishing in me." "He is preparing us, my child," answered the old woman, "for the striking of the last hour." At midnight, the nights of idleness were collecting, one by one, like shadows, under the trees of the Boulevard Baron, and speaking together in whispers. "What are we going to do?" was the first question of each as he arrived. "I think," said Francois,
that Max means merely to give us a supper.
No, matters are very serious for him and for the Rabouilleuse. No doubt he has concocted some scheme against the Parisians.
It would be a good joke to drive them away.
My grandfather, said Baruch, is terribly alarmed at having two extra mouths to feed, and he'd seize on any pretext.
Well, comrades, cried Max softly, now appearing on the scene, why are you stargazing? The planets don't distill Kirschwasser. Come, let us go to Mère Cognette's.
To Mère Cognette's, to Mère Cognette's, they all cried.
The cry, uttered as with one voice, produced a clamour which rang through the town like the hurrah of troops rushing to an assault. Total silence followed. The next day, more than one inhabitant must have said to his neighbour, "Did you hear those frightful cries last night? About 1 o'clock? I thought there was surely a fire somewhere." A supper worthy of La Cognette brightened the faces of the 22 guests, for the whole order was present. At 2 in the morning, as they were beginning to siroter, a word in the vocabulary of the knights which admirably expresses the act of sipping and tasting the wine in small quantities, Max rose to speak.
"My dear fellows, the honour of your grand master was grossly attacked this morning after our memorable joke with Fario's cart, attacked by a vile peddler, and what is more, a Spaniard. Oh, Cabrera! And I have resolved to make the scoundrel feel the weight of my vengeance, always, of course, within the limits we have laid down for our fun. After reflecting about it all day, I have found a trick which is worth putting into execution, a famous trick that will drive him crazy. While avenging the insult offered to the order in my person, we shall be feeding the sacred animals of the Egyptians, little beasts which are, after all, the creatures of God and which man unjustly persecutes. Thus we see that good is the child of evil, and evil is the offspring of good. Such is the paramount law of the universe. I now order you all, on pain of displeasing your very humble Grand Master, to procure clandestinely each one of you 20 rats, male or female, as heaven pleases. Collect your contingent within 3 days. If you can get more, the surplus will be welcome. Keep the interesting rodents without food, for it is essential that the delightful little beasts be ravenous with hunger. Please observe that I will accept both house mice and field mice as rats. If we multiply 22 by 20, we shall have 400. 400 accomplices let loose in the old church of the Capuchins, where Fario has stored all his grain, will consume a not insignificant quantity. But be lively about it, there's no time to lose. Fario is to deliver most of the grain to his customers in a week or so, and I am determined that that Spaniard shall find a terrible deficit. Gentlemen, I have not the merit of this invention, continued Max, observing the signs of general admiration. Render to Caesar that which is Caesar's, and to God that which is God's. My scheme is only a reproduction of Samson's foxes, as related in the Bible. But Samson was an incendiary, and therefore no philanthropist, while we, like the Brahmins, are the protectors of a persecuted race. Mademoiselle Flore Brazier has already set all her mouse-traps, and Kowski, my right arm, is hunting field mice. I have spoken.
I know, said Godet, where to find an animal that's worth 40 rats, himself alone.
What's that?
A squirrel.
I offer a little monkey, said one of the younger members. He'll make himself drunk on wheat.
Bad, very bad, exclaimed Max. It would show who put the beasts there.
But we might each catch a pigeon some night, said young Bossier, taking them from different farms. If we put them through a hole in the roof, they'll attract thousands of others.
So then, for the next week, Fario's storehouse is the order of the night, cried Max, smiling at Bossier. Recollect, people get up early in Saint-Patern. Mind, too, that none of you go there without turning the soles of your list shoes backward. Knight Bossier, the inventor of pigeons, is made director. As for me, I shall take care to leave my imprint on the sacks of wheat. Gentlemen, you are, all of you, appointed to the commissariat of the army of rats. If you find a watchman sleeping in the church, you must manage to make him drunk, and do it cleverly, so as to get him far away from the scene of the rodent's orgy.
You don't say anything about the Parisians? Questioned Godet.
Oh, exclaimed Max, I want time to study them. Meantime, I offer my best shotgun, the one the Emperor gave me, a treasure from the manufactory at Versailles, to whoever finds a way to play the Brideaux a trick which shall get them into difficulties with Madame and Monsieur Auchan, so that those worthy old people shall send them off, or they shall be forced to go of their own accord, without, understand me, injuring the venerable ancestors of my two friends here present, Baruch and Francois.
All right, I'll think of it, said Godet, who coveted the gun.
If the inventor of the trick doesn't care for the gun, he shall have my horse, added Max. After this night, 20 brains were tortured to lay a plot against Agathe and her son on the basis of Max's program. But the devil alone, or chance, could really help them to success, for the conditions given made the thing well-nigh impossible.
The next morning, Agathe and Joseph came downstairs just before the second breakfast, which took place at 10 o'clock. In Monsieur Auchan's household, the name of first breakfast was given to a cup of milk and slice of bread and butter, which was taken in bed or when rising. While waiting for Madame Auchan, who, notwithstanding her age, went minutely through the ceremonies with which the duchesses of Louis the XV's time performed their toilette, Joseph noticed Jean-Jacques Rouget planted squarely on his feet at the door of his house across the street. He naturally pointed him out to his mother, who was unable to recognize her brother, so little did he look like what he was when she left him.
"That is your brother," said Adolphine, who entered, giving an arm to her grandmother.
"What an idiot he looks like!" exclaimed Joseph.
Agathe clasped her hands and raised her eyes to heaven.
"What a state they have driven him to! Good God, can that be a man only 57 years old?"
She looked attentively at her brother and saw Flore Brazier standing directly behind him, with her hair dressed, a pair of snowy shoulders and a dazzling bosom showing through a gauze neckerchief which was trimmed with lace. She was wearing a dress with a tight-fitting waist, made of grenadine, a silk material then much in fashion, with leg-of-mutton sleeves, so-called, fastened at the wrists by handsome bracelets. A gold chain rippled over the crab girl's bosom as she leaned forward to give Jean-Jacques his black silk cap, lest he should take cold. The scene was evidently studied.
"Hey!" cried Joseph. "There's a fine woman, and a rare one. She is made, as they say, to paint. What flesh tints! Oh, the lovely tones! What surface! What curves! Ah, those shoulders! She's a magnificent caryatid. What a model she would have been for one of Titian's Venuses!"
Adolphine and Madame Auchan thought he was talking Greek, but Agathe signed to them behind his back,
as if to say that she was accustomed to such jargon.
"So you think a creature who is depriving you of your property handsome?" said Madame Auchan.
"That doesn't prevent her from being a splendid model, just plump enough not to spoil the hips and the general contour."
"My son, you are not in your studio," said Agathe. "Adolphine is here."
"Ah, true, I did wrong. But you must remember that ever since leaving Paris I have seen nothing but ugly women."
"My dear godmother," said Agathe hastily, "how shall I be able to meet my brother if that creature is always with him?"
"Bah," said Joseph, "I'll go and see him myself. I don't think him such an idiot now I find he has the sense to rejoice his eyes with a Titian's Venus."
"If he were not an idiot," said Monsieur Auchan, who had come in, "he would have married long ago and had children, and then you would have had no chance at the property. It is an ill wind that blows no good."
"Your son's idea is very good," said Madame Auchan. "He ought to pay the first visit. He can make his uncle understand that if you call there, he must be alone."
"That will affront Mademoiselle Brazier," said old Auchan. "No, no, madame, swallow the pill. If you can't get the whole property, secure a small legacy."
The Auchans were not clever enough to match Max. In the middle of breakfast, Kowski brought over a letter from Monsieur Rouget, addressed to his sister, Madame Bridau. Madame Auchan made her husband read it aloud, as follows. "My dear sister, I learn from strangers of your arrival in Issoudun. I can guess the reason which made you prefer the house of Monsieur and Madame Auchan to mine. But if you will come to see me, you shall be received as you ought to be. I should certainly pay you the first visit, if my health did not compel me just now to keep the house, for which I offer my affectionate regrets. I shall be delighted to see my nephew, whom I invite to dine with me tomorrow. Young men are less sensitive than women about the company. It will give me pleasure if Messieurs Baruch Borniche and François Auchan will accompany him. Your affectionate brother, J. J. Rouget."
"Say that we are at breakfast, but that Madame Bridau will send an answer presently, and the invitations are all accepted," said Monsieur Auchan to the servant.
The old man laid a finger on his lips to require silence from everybody. When the street door was shut, Monsieur Auchan, little suspecting the intimacy between his grandsons and Max, threw one of his slyest looks at his wife and Agathe, remarking,
"He is just as capable of writing that note as I am of giving away 25 louis. It is the soldier who is corresponding with us."
"What does that portend?" asked Madame Auchan. "Well, never mind. We will answer him. As for you, monsieur," she added, turning to Joseph, "you must dine there. But if—" The old lady was stopped short by a look from her husband. Knowing how warm a friendship she felt for Agathe, old Auchan was in dread lest she should leave some legacy to her goddaughter, in case the latter lost the Rouget property. Though 15 years older than his wife, the miser hoped to inherit her fortune, and to become, eventually, the sole master of their whole property. That hope was a fixed idea with him. Madame Auchan knew that the best means of obtaining a few concessions from her husband was to threaten him with her will. Monsieur Auchan now took sides with his guests. An enormous fortune was at stake. With a sense of social justice, he wished it to go to the natural heirs instead of being pillaged by unworthy outsiders. Moreover, the sooner the matter was decided, the sooner he should get rid of his guests. Now that the struggle between the interlopers and the heirs, hitherto existing only in his wife's mind, had become an actual fact, Monsieur Auchan's keen intelligence, lulled to sleep by the monotony of provincial life, was fully roused. Madame Auchan had been agreeably surprised that morning to perceive, from a few affectionate words which the old man had said to her about Agathe, that so able and subtle an auxiliary was on the Bridau side. Towards midday, the brains of Monsieur and Madame Auchan, of Agathe and Joseph, the latter much amazed at the scrupulous care of the old people in the choice of words, were delivered of the following answer, concocted solely for the benefit of Max and Flore. "My dear brother, if I have stayed away from Issoudun and kept up no intercourse with anyone, not even with you, the fault lies not merely with the strange and false ideas my father conceived about me, but with the joys and sorrows of my life in Paris. For if God made me a happy wife, he has also deeply afflicted me as a mother. You are aware that my son, your nephew Philippe, lies under accusation of a capital offence in consequence of his devotion to the emperor. Therefore, you can hardly be surprised if a widow compelled to take a humble situation in a lottery office for a living should come to seek consolation from those among whom she was born. The profession adopted by the son who accompanies me is one that requires great talent, many sacrifices, and prolonged studies before any results can be obtained. Glory for an artist precedes fortune. Is not that to say that Joseph, though he may bring honour to the family, will still be poor? Your sister, my dear Jean-Jacques, would have borne in silence the penalties of paternal injustice, but you will pardon a mother for reminding you that you have two nephews, one of whom carried the emperor's orders at the Battle of Montereau and served in the guard at Waterloo, and is now in prison for his devotion to Napoleon. The other, from his 13th year, has been impelled by natural gifts to enter a difficult, though glorious, career. I thank you for your letter, my dear brother, with heartfelt warmth, for my own sake, and also for Joseph's, who will certainly accept your invitation. Illness excuses everything, my dear Jean-Jacques, and I shall therefore go to see you in your own house. A sister is always at home with a brother, no matter what may be the life he has adopted. I embrace you tenderly. Agathe Rouget. There's the matter started. Now, when you see him, said Monsieur Auchan to Agathe, you must speak plainly to him about his nephews. The letter was carried over by Grete, who returned 10 minutes later to render an account to her masters of all that she had seen and heard, according to a settled provincial custom.
Since yesterday, Madame has had the whole house cleaned up, which she left.
"Whom do you mean by Madame?" asked old Auchan.
"That's what they call the Rabouilleuse over there," answered Grete. "She left the salon and all Monsieur Rouget's part of the house in a pitiable state. But since yesterday the rooms have been made to look like what they were before Monsieur Maxence went to live there. You can see your face on the floors. La Védie told me that Kowski went off on horseback at 5 o'clock this morning and came back at 9, bringing provisions. It is going to be a grand dinner, a dinner fit for the Archbishop of Bourges. There's a fine bustle in the kitchen, and they are as busy as bees. The old man says, 'I want to do honour to my nephew,' and he pokes his nose into everything. It appears the Rougets are highly flattered by the letter.
Madame came and told me so. Oh, she had on such a dress! I never saw anything so handsome in my life. Two diamonds in her ears, two diamonds that cost, Védi told me, 3,000 francs apiece, and such lace, rings on her fingers and bracelets. You'd think she was a shrine, and a silk dress as fine as an altar cloth. So then she said to me, Monsieur is delighted to find his sister so amiable, and I hope she will permit us to pay her all the attention she deserves. We shall count on her good opinion after the welcome we mean to give her son. Monsieur is very impatient to see his nephew. Madame had little black satin slippers, and her stockings, ah, they were marvels. Flowers in silk and open work, just like lace, and you could see her rosy little feet through them. Oh, she's in high feather, and she had a lovely little apron in front of her, which, Védi says, cost more than 2 years of our wages put together. Well done, we shall have to dress up, said the artist, laughing. What do you think of all this, Monsieur Auchan? Said the old lady when Griet had departed. Madame Auchan made Agathe observe her husband, who was sitting with his head in his hands, his elbows on the arms of his chair, plunged in thought. "You have to do with a maître bonnet," said the old man at last. "With your ideas, young man," he added, looking at Joseph, "you haven't force enough to struggle with a practiced scoundrel like Maxence Gilet. No matter what I say to you, you will commit some folly. But at any rate, tell me everything you see and hear and do tonight. Go, and God be with you. Try to get alone with your uncle. If, in spite of all your genius, you can't manage it, that in itself will throw some light upon their scheme. But if you do get a moment alone with him, out of earshot, damn it, you must pull the wool from his eyes as to the situation those two have put him in, and plead your mother's cause." End of chapter 11.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.